countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal. Follow our new Weanling Watch series for expert analysis and commentary from thousands of cattle sales weekly.
Now on RTE Radio 1, it's time for this week's Countrywide with Damien O'Reilly.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal, bringing 295,000 readers the latest farming news and the best of rural Ireland weekly.
Good morning and welcome to the programme. Coming up between now and 9 o'clock, what does the COP26 conference have in store for farmers? A new book explores our obsession with land, surviving a month of eating only locally grown food, and how's hospitality recovering post-lockdown?
Text 51551, email countrywide at rte.ie and tweet at RTE Countrywide.
But first, I'm on the farm of Patrick Bradley on the shore of Garradice Loch, outside New Tangor in County Leitrim.
And that's linked up to the Shannon Éireann waterway, so you can go out there and go left to Limerick or right to Donegal.
Patrick grew up here on the family dairy farm.
So I grew up and went to school here. And
the dairy herd of 60 cows is still here, but Patrick is not a conventional dairy farmer. He sells raw milk direct to shops dotted across the country. He also supplies milk to the makers of Corlegi cheese in neighbouring County Cavan, and he supplies the surplus milk to Lakeland Dairies.
Yeah, I always farmed, and I always had interest in cows and machinery. Machinery for a while, then it went out of my system. But always cows. I can remember cows that was bought when I was only 4 or 5. And I just have a natural affinity for cows.
Right, so this was a traditional, conventional dairy farm?
Yeah.
And at what stage did you go into the raw milk end of things?
Well, we started 4.5 years ago into raw milk, shortly after it was legalised. There is a bit of a story of why. Everybody used their own milk back, we'll say, 40 years ago or so. And when my youngest sister was born, my mother, God rest her in her wisdom, she changed to shop milk because there was TB, brucellosis and various things about at the time. And that stayed that way for years and years until I was in a bit bad form and I was at the doctor and they'd tell me, try this, try that, which I did, nothing worked. So I got a live blood analysis done and they used some formula then to tell you what not to eat and all that. So they put me, God knows, off everything. I thought I was going to have to eat grass. So what you do is you do that and you slowly introduce food back in and you find what's your killer. So a few days in, I had the most desperate protein want on me and I literally got a mug and drank milk out of the milk tank. And I felt it went into every part of my body. And I got well. I lost 3 stone in weight and my stomach got well. And I just said, like, it's mad not to bring this to the people. Mm. And I don't actually use that story, only we're talking about it. I don't use it in marketing or anything like that. It's just how I am.
So when you took when you drank that mug of raw milk from the milk tank on the farm, that was your eureka moment?
It was, absolutely. When we got everything into place, it was like then 4.5 years ago till we got started.
Up until 2015, the commercial sale of raw milk was prohibited. But now, under new legislation, raw milk suppliers, such as Patrick, must register with the Department of Agriculture and are subject to relevant supervision from that department.
And then Raw Milk Ireland was born, and Elizabeth Ryan and Mimi Crawford, they're the reason I'm at it, because I'd never got started without them.
Elizabeth Ryan is one of the founders of Raw Milk Ireland.
Raw milk was due to be banned going back as far as 2011. A number of people from the food community got together and decided that this wasn't a great thing to happen. And after quite a lot of campaigning on the matter, around 2015, 2016, it was agreed that what we would do instead is that the raw milk farmers would devise a set of guidelines in consultation with the Food Safety Authority of Ireland and the Department of Agriculture. There's 13 registered producers of raw milk in Ireland as it stands. Now, there is an exemption there for people who want to sell 30 litres of milk within 20 kilometres of their farm where they don't need to register. So that means a number of producers could be in existence that are perhaps selling to neighbours or maybe selling at a local market and whatnot. So, you know, the figure could be in excess of sort of 20, 25 or maybe even a little bit more. A lot of people don't necessarily know what raw milk is. There's also a lot of people that might have concerns about drinking raw milk because they would see it as posing a danger. And there are, of course, inherent risks to drinking raw milk, the same as a lot of foodstuffs. And certainly, without speaking on behalf of the FSAI, they would certainly still not recommend the consumption of raw milk, and very especially in the case of elderly people and infants and younger children. All that being said, there's a lot of interest from a wide variety of sectors. There's a nostalgia there. So you've got a group of people who would have grown up drinking raw milk always. And you know, this is something we always said, it's not raw milk, it's milk. It is milk as it sort of was intended, not to denigrate the benefits of pasteurisation. Then you've got a whole sort of new group of people who are interested in health foods. They see raw milk as having health benefits, but it is a niche market.
Let's move on.
Back in the Bradley holding, Patrick shows me where the brand, called For Gut's Sake, is chilled and bottled before being loaded into his van to be taken to shops around the country.
Look at where we bottled the milk first.
Yeah.
So basically it comes from that tank.
So Damien, this is where we do the bottling. The bottles come into a bottle store there. We crate them up and the milk is coming in. It comes in at 1.5 degrees into this jar, and we actually fill them one bottle at a time. So 1 litre bottle, it takes a few seconds to fill it, that's all.
So, one at a time.
Yeah, so it might sound very laborious, but actually you do a couple of hundred there, or 300 in an hour maybe, you know.
From the cow to that bottle, what sort of process has it gone through?
Okay, so it goes directly from the cow through a filter system, and we have an ice bank water cooler with a pump which cools it down very quickly. It's then stored at 1.5 degrees and it's pumped back to this jar where it goes through a second filtration. And that's the only thing. There's nothing added. There's nothing taken away. It's just double filtered. Double filtered through microgauze filters.
And that milk has come from the cow that was milked this morning?
Yeah.
And it'll be on the shop shelf?
Tomorrow morning.
It's like a 1, 2, 3-man sort of operation that you have here. There's no big machinery or anything like that. The bottles are filled by hand.
Yeah.
You put them into the van out here.
Yeah.
And then that van takes off. You deliver yourself, do you?
I do the deliveries, yeah.
And how many shops or how many customers do you have now, roughly?
I think we probably do upwards of 70 shops, but I wouldn't be going to 70 places. Some of them are depots that distribute themselves, you know.
Oh, so here we are in the field now, which are ladies. You've quite a mix of breeds here, do you?
Oh yeah, we've a big mix of breeds here now. We have that cow there now will be a sort of typical Holstein cow, which
yeah.
We only have two or three of. The red one there is Ayrshire.
Yeah.
We have Jersey Cross. We have Shorthorn Cross. And we've just introduced some Norwegian Red and some Fleckvie as well.
Okay, and why the mix of breeds?
We cut back from the Holstein breed because these other cows are more suited to once a day.
Okay. And you milk them once a day?
We only milk once a day,
okay.
Yeah, yeah. I went to a raw milk meeting back in 2017, and I talked to a gentleman called Sean Condon from Limerick, who's also in the raw milk business, and he's a once a day man. And as I say, the first thing I did when I came home was I didn't milk, and never have done since. He convinced me there and then. And it just happened to be at the right time of year. And we just stopped milking twice a day. And it's great. The health of the cows is unbelievable. Them cows are all in good condition. And they haven't had a pound of meal since the 1st of April. Nor won't be getting any till maybe the middle of next month.
All right. And does it affect the yield, though?
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Well, we're not about volume anymore. I don't even know what they're given. And that's right. A fact. We only concentrate on quality now and solids. Like, we're farm to fork or farm to glass. Like, as you can see here, I have respect for the land, for the cow, for the product, and for my customers. And that's why I do it. Yeah, of course, I'm making a bit of money. But if you have a big herd, if you don't have family support, it won't work.
Right.
Like, everything we do here, we do ourselves.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, the very best of luck to you, Patrick. Thanks very much for chatting to us, and good luck for the future.
Right, thanks yourself. Thanks for coming.
That was Patrick Bradley there among his herd of cows in Leitrim, and he also sells his raw milk online, and you can find out more details and read all about it on www.forgutsake.ie, forgutsake.ie. And we also heard there from food consultant Elizabeth Ryan, and if you check out the Department of Agriculture website, you can find out more details on raw milk regulation. Now, land is something, it is said, that we're obsessed with in Ireland. And Nicholas Green, a professor of English literature at TCD and also a farmer himself, has written a book entitled Farming in Modern Irish Literature. And Suzanne Campbell has been reading the book. And in fact, you went down and met Nicholas, Suzanne.
I did indeed. He's not far from me, down in Ballinaclash, which is a small little village in Wicklow. And he has this fascinating farm that actually comes right into the crossroads of the village. His house was at the crossroads at the bridge. And the farm extends back from that. It's about 120 acres. He still farms, Nicholas, in partnership with a neighbour. Yeah. And it's mainly tillage now. And he's got rid of all his livestock. And he says he doesn't really miss it, but I kind of think he does. But anyway, I went down to talk about this new book. I mean, he's written lots about Shakespeare and Yeats. He's a very well-known writer on literature in Ireland. But in this, he turns to the rural experience and land. And he writes about such a range of people. I mean, from Anne Enright to Edna O'Brien to also, I suppose, the writers that we really associate with this territory, like Patrick Kavanagh, Seamus Heaney, John McGahern. And I suppose I asked him to take me around his farm and his experience of growing up in those post-war decades of the traditional Irish farm, which many of us would still be familiar with, right up to the 1980s and 1990s. Those practices were kind of still the same. And particularly those early decades when he was growing up.
This was the original dwelling house here. It would have been thatched, even in memory of an old man who used to work with me. He can remember the thatch there. Mm. And then they would have built on this very conventional farmhouse with two rooms on either side of an entrance hall. So that's where I grew up.
You use a phrase in the introduction of your book. Is it a Heaney phrase that everything is hand-done? It describes that period, really, in Ireland that so many people would be familiar with.
He talks about an age of bare hands and cast iron.
That's it.
And what triggered that poem of his, it's called The Turnip Snedder, a turnip pulper. It's mm-hmm. a Philip Pierce turnip pulper. And I remember this so well because we had one right up here.
Yeah.
And that feeling of turning the handle of the turnip pulper. And, you know, he describes the way in which the pulp comes down at the bottom.
Yeah.
But it's that sense of kind of intimate contact, you know, with the materials and with the cows. Of course, we hand milked all our cows at mm-hmm. that stage. And my father had this passion about horses. Even in the 1950s, he wouldn't have a tractor here. He had all horses.
Goodness.
And he had a whole theory about it. I think it's what in India would be called intermediate technology. He felt that the investment, big capital investment in machines that we didn't need for this size of farm
yeah.
was a waste when you still could do things by horsepower. And admittedly, it has to be said, there was relatively cheap labour at the time. We had two people working on the farm full time.
Farms, that's a key thing. I mean, labour was cheap then. Men's labour was cheap to buy. And we know that was a real issue, I suppose, for the working class man and woman and the mm-hmm. and the rural man particularly. But it also made, I suppose, farms much more dense with people. There were much more people working on farms and there was much more people living in the rural landscape then. You know, when you walk around farms, there are bits of cottages everywhere. And we have to remember, I suppose, it was 8 million plus people in Ireland, mostly in rural Ireland, before the famine. And I suppose that rich population made a very different experience and the work was much more physical as well.
I mean, what I find very moving about the farm here, when we came here, the names of the fields were all names of individual people, individual families. So down there was the Kavanagh's Meadows. We're going to go up through the Hopkins Field, the Carty's Far Field, Judy's Meadows and Tom's Field. All of those would actually have been separate people who lived on this farm. This is pre-famine, presumably, you know.
Oh, my goodness, what a view.
This is silage, but in my day it would have been hay. Silage is a new thing for us, you know. So I associate very much with the kind of scene that John McGahern describes in Amongst Women, you know, all hands on deck to bring in the hay. I'll just read a little piece that McGahern has. It's Moran and Great Meadow, the tyrant father getting all the family out. As soon as the dew was burned off the grass, the whole house was in the hayfield, shaking out the heavy tangled lumps of grass that Tedder had missed with the fork, raking what was light in from the edges. Towards evening, when the grass started to take on the dry crackle of hay, it was as if the small handshakings were springing up in the meadow. For five whole glaring days, they worked like this, too tired and stiff at night to want to go anywhere but to bed.
So we all remember, I suppose, Damien, you know, the days bringing in hay. Could you ever forget it? I mean, I remember on my mum's.
I used to love it, actually.
Yeah, you'd love it. But you'd love it, I suppose, because it was such camaraderie and camellia. And I remember on my mum's farm in Fermanagh, we'd bring the tea out to the men, you know, the bottle that had the tea in it with the milk in it. And of course, I used to get hay fever, which no one really cared about then. So my eyes would be out to here. I'd be streaming. I couldn't breathe for about 5 days.
No, I loved lifting the square bales onto the flat trailer, except if you get into a thistly field.
Oh God, the thistles, and you'd be pulling them out of your hair and everything later. I mean, I suppose what we remember is, you know, the good bits and not the bad bits. And, you know, I asked Nicholas about, I suppose, that even with the huge changes that we've had, how important land is. It's such an important part of our identity, and it appears so much in Irish literature.
From the time after the famine, the families who managed to get hold of the small family farm were determined that just one child would inherit, and it was almost always a son. But it wasn't necessarily the oldest son. It was whoever was they thought was best for the farm. But with large families, that was a big question about which one was going to inherit, when would they inherit, when would the parents decide to give up. And what would happen to all the other children? Mm-hmm. They had to emigrate. If they were a little bit up in the social scale, they might become a priest or a nun. But some of them became writers. And it's this class of writer that I'm particularly interested in. You know, the Seamus Heaneys. John McGahern is one generation away from that because his father was a guard. But it's this investment in the land and in the farm and turning that into literature. That group who sort of came of age after independence, that's where I decided I wanted to focus.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think we are so nostalgic? Particularly, I mean, everyone who had a granny or someone in the countryside or summers with an uncle milking or something, why is it so vibrant a theme? And, you know, we see throughout Irish writing so much.
Well, I think there are a number of answers to that. The first one is kind of political. Gaining the land, gaining ownership of the land, those small farms had been so hard fought for, so struggled for. Mm. So people were very tenacious. The farm had to be kept in the family. So there's that kind of investment. But also, I think what I was talking earlier about that sense of the intimacy with the land, you know, children at that stage would actually have been involved in a very direct way.
They'd have been touching and feeling it. Yes.
Feeding calves, milking cows, feeding pigs. And I think that's part of the reason why for writers who, you know, most of them lived in cities, became kind of middle-class writers, there is this enormous imaginative investment in the time when they're really close into the land, to animals, and to the very tight-knit community that went with that.
That's Nicholas Green there. He wrote Farming in Modern Irish Literature, published by Oxford University Press. It can be ordered from most bookshops and is available online as well. And he was speaking with Suzanne Campbell.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal, bringing you expert analysis on what the new CAP deal means for you and your farm payments.
The COP26 meeting in Scotland in November is being billed by many as the last chance saloon summit to find a pathway to limit global warming at 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels. Now, when it comes to food production, farmers here are facing significant challenges, not least with policy changes aimed at reducing methane emissions and improving air, water and soil quality. The government's Climate Action Bill and the EU's Farm to Fork project are just two initiatives which map out the direction of travel required to meet targets. I'm joined now by Professor John Sweeney, Emeritus Professor of Geography at NUI Maynooth and climatologist, and Kieran Fitzgerald, Agri-Food Economist and former Chair of Meat Industry Ireland. You're both very welcome. John, if I can go to you first, you'll be going home to Glasgow for this huge event. Will you outline just how significant the COP26 two-week conference in Scotland is going to be?
Well, it certainly is a highly significant event. Will attract somewhere between 20 and 25,000 participants to this individual event. But it is a landmark event in the history of climate policy because I guess it's going to be informed by the really radical conclusions that came out last month from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which the Irish government has now signed up to as well. And really what that gave us, as we now know, was a red code red warning, as the Secretary General said. It's really a 999 call. And what the outcome of that was essentially that we're on the wrong track for global climate change and that we will pass some of those critical thresholds within the next 20 years, which may cause tipping points in our climate globally as well as locally.
Okay.
And that's really telling the people that are going to Glasgow that really that there's are very important decisions to be made in terms of radical changes in direction for many of our sectors. And one of the key things which emerged yesterday as countries, if you like, get together to try and smooth the path to those global agreements was an agreement between the United States and the EU to cut global methane emissions by 30% in the next decade. That has ramifications, as you'll see instantly, of course, or appreciate instantly, for countries like Ireland, and that's going to be, if you like, informing the negotiators as they take part in COP26.
Okay, Kieran Fitzgerald, radical changes will be required. The impact of dairy expansion in Ireland is evidenced in various EPA reports in recent years. Is Irish agriculture match fit now to meet the targets that need to be met by 2030?
Well, again, Damien, I think this is a huge issue, not just for Irish agriculture, but for economies. And I think one of the unfortunate polarisations of discussions in Ireland is that we only seem to ever discuss agriculture when the really deep and hard part of implementation of the climate change actions is going to be right across the economy, and a particularly a deeply fossil fuel based society and economy, and there's going to be dramatic changes required there. To answer your point specifically about agriculture, agriculture will adopt if we're dealing with the imperatives of needing to improve our environmental impact and adapt to climate change challenges. And we have shown that in the last 20 years. And one of the key strengths of how that happens, Damien, actually, is that we are an internationalised agriculture. We export to 130 countries. So Irish agriculture, as a supplier and a key part of food supply chains to multinational companies and retailers worldwide, will have to address its decarbonisation challenges and will have to meet targets. And as well as that, we have the legislation coming through on carbon budgets. So if we get a broader view on how this is going to happen in terms of decarbonising our society, and if we move away from the mischaracterisation of agriculture, which we've had for the last 2 years, then we will bring people with us. And I think that's the key for the implementation of policy right across economies. The key challenge is how do you bring people with you? And certainly you don't do it in the way that we've had for the last 2 years here on the basis of polarisation and mischaracterisation.
Okay, and maybe that comes from both sides to an extent as well. But
no, I don't think it has come. The agricultural sector hasn't, if you like, mischaracterised anybody else in terms of what's going on. And I really do think this is a key part of whether this thing actually happens is implementation. We've had far too much virtue signalling and a lot of ethical superior... if you like, you know, obfuscation on this, and we really need to get a practical approach, explain it to everybody in the economy, because it isn't just agriculture that will have to change dramatically, it's other sectors also.
Okay, so John, just on that again, going back to COP and the changes and the limitations on the carbon budget for agriculture that will be discussed at that, and on that issue, farm lobbyists, they use the argument that any reduction in Irish meat and dairy production will lead to what's termed as outsourcing of emissions to other countries. How do you respond to that?
Well, we count our emissions nationally. It's not of concern to us what happens in other countries in terms of our legislation. Irish agriculture is now bound by the climate bill, and it's bound to therefore make its contribution to a 51% reduction over the next 10 years. Now, it's all, I think, you know, if I was a farmer, and I'm a great admirer of farmers, if I was a farmer, I would be hopping mad at this stage, the extent to which farming has come to the table here unprepared for what's coming down the line. The reality is that the legislative requirement, even if we reduce emissions in agriculture by 33% in the next 10 years, that will impose on the rest of society a requirement to reduce by 70%. Now, that's where the divisions will come in, and that's what I don't want to see in the future, because I think agriculture is well positioned to adapt if it takes the necessary steps. But it has been led up a policy cul-de-sac over the past 10 years. We've had a whole host of policies which have been driven primarily by industry-led rather than farmer-led policies. Mm-hmm. And that's really, I think, leaving agriculture extremely exposed, not just to divisions in society in the next few years, but really to the radical reductions, which I think will be very difficult for agriculture to achieve.
Okay, but just John, on that very briefly, consumption, should the consumer, the where the food is consumed rather than where it's produced, should that account for the carbon?
I agree completely. We don't pay enough for our food. We don't pay enough to our farmers. Our farmers are price takers rather than price makers. And unfortunately, you know, the farmers have been led through misdirected policies such as Agri-Food 2030 into believing that continuous expansion is a possibility for the next 10 years.
Okay.
It's not. And we have to accept that.
Okay, Ciarán, just on that, I read this morning the Minister for Agriculture, Charlie McConnellogue, announcing significant advances in gaining access to the Chinese market for Irish sheep meat and live breeding pigs. Now, while that's great news on one front in terms of new business, it kind of smacks of, you know, what the environmental, let's say, is business as usual, that we Irish agriculture has been more focused on increasing production and exports at the expense of the environment and biodiversity loss over the past 10 years.
Well, I, that is just not true. I mean, growth came, Damien, fundamentally because the EU changed its legislation. So EU legislation changed the possibility that you could produce more milk than you had for 30 years. And with regard to the overall point that, you know, Irish agriculture is pursuing growth, we clearly have reached a situation now and where it is going to be difficult, but it is accepted that there is going to have to be some form of capping of livestock numbers. And with regard to the issue of price, with great respect, there is no stomach in Ireland or in the EU to rebalance what's happening in terms of what the consumer is paying for food and the extra cost of producing food. And the final point I'd make is one of the things the environmentalists continue to omit from any discussion of climate change is Article 3 of the Paris Accord, which says that all of the new measures to reduce emissions must be taken into the context of not suppressing food production. So there is a very specific category of food production which tends to be ignored, in the broader discussion. And yes, agriculture will play its part. It plays a huge economic part in the Irish economy, and it will play a better and improving economic part and an environmental part in the economy into the future.
Okay, thanks indeed for that, Ciarán. And Professor John Sweeney, enjoy your trip to back home to Glasgow, where you grew up, for that conference, along with many thousands of other people, which begins, as I said, on the 31st of October and runs for a while after that. So, Ciarán and John, thank you both very much for joining us. And that's a discussion we will continue to have over the coming weeks and months. Now, Ireland is very proud of being a food-producing nation, but if any of us opened our kitchen cupboards right now, what chance that everything is 100% Irish ingredients? Well, Kerry farmers and growers Lisa Fingleton and our partner Rena have been spearheading the 30-day food challenge over the past number of years, where people only eat food grown in Ireland for the month of September. Our reporter Hannah Quinn Mulligan recently visited their farm, which lies just outside Ballybunion, to find out what was on their dinner menu.
So, we took some salad or some basil.
Smell that salad.
That smells amazing.
Isn't it amazing?
I think I've spied in the corner. Are those grapes? Do you have grapes growing in this poly? Are you going to make Ballybunion wine? Is that what's going to happen?
Oh, Hannah, we just need somebody that's good at wine making to come. Come on, we'll get a scissors. I'll cut some down. You know what people a lot of the time say to me in the food challenge? Oh, but I miss my chilies or my hot things. And I'm like, well, why don't you just grow them? Because they grow really well.
Explain the food challenge to me. What is it exactly?
So the 30-day food challenge is basically where people eat only food grown on the island of Ireland for 30 days. So we started it 6 years ago because I was so concerned about the fact that there was such a gap between what's growing in the fields and what people were eating. And when I go into, say if I'm working and I go into a small shop and I try and maybe support a local grower or a food producer, there's actually nothing I can buy in a shop.
Because you and your partner, Rena, you're here just outside Ballybunion in County Kerry, and you have a lovely small farm here. You're growing lots of vegetables in polytunnels on this kind of site that's maybe about half the size of a football pitch. And as well as that, you're grazing some cattle as well. Did I read, though, that this was all inspired by a BLT sandwich that you bought in a shop?
Oh, stop. You see, the thing about it is, you can see here, Hannah, we grow almost everything we need. So, and I grew up like that as well. I grew up in Laois on a farm, and my dad grew everything. So genuinely, I didn't really realise that people like bought so much food. I think we've lost the run of ourselves a little bit in terms of labelling. You know, so now if I import rice and I add profit to it and I sell it as sushi, then that becomes an Irish product, even though there's no connection with the farm. And I think that connection between the farm and the product that people are eating has been lost. Now, look, I understand, I have a background in marketing as well. I know things have to be marketed. But I do think something like Blasna Héireann, we need to be reminded what the Blasna Héireann, what is the taste of Ireland? And the taste of Ireland can be as diverse as you like. But I think it's really important that we grow the food and we support people to grow food. I mean, we're facing a climate crisis. We saw there was a storm here a couple of years ago in Ballybunion, and 4 days, and there was all signs in the local Super Value saying the truck couldn't get through. So in my mind, I thought, OK, this is unpleasant, but it will wake people up to the reality that we need to be more, you know, resilient in our food production. We need to be producing food. And yet, you know, only 1% of farms are producing vegetables. I just find it worrying.
Okay, but we are going to have a celebration of local food now, and we are going to pick some vegetables and some fruit that we are going to eat for dinner tonight. You and Rena are going to make me dinner. That's really why I came here. Just have dinner made.
Yeah.
So we've come through the garden area, down a little woodland path, and we're just emerging into this beautiful orchard, and the trees are just laden. It's so peaceful down here. I'm just wondering, what's the view, say, that I'm seeing as we walk up here towards the chickens?
So at the back of us is a mountain or a hill called Cnuconor.
Does that mean the Hill of Gold?
Hill of Gold, yeah. We think it's because of connected to the harvest, that maybe harvest festivals, fires on top of the hill. It's the tallest hill around in North Kerry. So when you look over there, Hannah, you'll see that fence, there's 10,000 trees there. And I know there's 10,000 because we got a printout of the count, and I saw them all arriving in their bags. So it's really lovely, like 3,000 oak and hawthorn and, you know, everything rowan. It's beautiful. Now, will we go? I suppose we're going to Rena.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Hi, Rena. How are you?
Hello, Hannah. How are you doing? How would you walk about?
It was very nice, very informative.
It's hot, isn't it?
It's a beautiful day.
It's a hot day out there.
It's here. What are you slicing?
I know. This is out of desperation about an hour ago, I have a sugar craving, and we didn't have anything in the house, so I had to run up and get some apples. So I'm going to attempt to make an apple. It is going to be an apple crumble, but it's extraordinary to when you're on this like 30-day food challenge, like the lack of sugar and the lack of raw ingredients around you. If you're really trying to keep it, it's hard. It really is.
So it's going to be apple pie with honey and an oat crumble.
Yes, yeah.
Okay, and we'll have it in about an hour.
I'd say 45 minutes, yes, because it does take long for this to do. So it could be about 45 minutes, yeah. So okay. We'll see how it goes.
We'll stick it in the oven. Because obviously when everyone goes to make an apple pie, there is, you just go to the fridge or go to the cupboard and you get butter, you get your flour.
Yes, yeah.
And you obviously mix them together to make your pastry.
Yeah.
But most of the flour in Ireland comes from France or England. So
France or England. Actually, I have a lot of flour that we have in the cupboard here and I can't use any of it. But and the apple pie, like I grew up with my gran. Actually, my gran was in this house, was born in this house. So, and she was a very resourceful woman. So it was apple pie, apple crumble or anything else.
Is this a long-term thing that you would have been outside as a child picking apples and would have brought apples into her to make apple pie?
So what she would do is send me on my bike to rob apples because we never had an orchard of our own, but I knew every orchard within a 5 mile radius. So I went off every August, September with a knapsack and came back, I'd say at least once a week, every week, and she stored them all winter. So, but I was the orchard robber. I was small, slight, and I could climb. So yeah. But look, that needs be. Nan, my gran was she was such a resourceful woman. Like everything came from her. Okie dokie. I think, guys, you smelt pie. It's just about ready. In fact, it is ready. Oh,
it smells good.
Looks good, doesn't it?
Oh my god!
It's nearly snow. Will you get me something so I can put it down?
Here's the honey. Mm.
Isn't that
nice? That's delicious. I've never done.
Cool.
Well done,
Rena. I'm delighted you like it.
Yeah. And this is Emily's honey all the way from Tarbert.
Yes.
So it's a Kerry pie, essentially, between.
Basically, it's all within a.
It's a Kerry tart! But not a tart, obviously.
It's.
Because it's the crumble.
Simply divine honey.
For a lot of people, they're going to be wondering, you know, well, we're kind of in the first week of September. Can they still do it or are they cheating?
Oh, no, absolutely. Like the thing about the food challenge is people can join in for a day. They can join in for, they can decide, oh, sure, do breakfast for a week. So that's what it's really about. Just sharing food, sharing fun, and hopefully we'll all learn something along the way. Mm-hmm. So enjoy your dinner.
Thank you very much. Cheers.
Cheers.
That's Hannah Quinn Mulligan there with that report. And if you'd like to find out more about the challenge, you can visit Lisa's website at lisafingleton.com. Now, we had a couple of texts and emails in relation to our discussion. I suppose this kind of sums up where we are in relation to the environmental and farming discussion on the future. We have Phelan Murnian saying, listening to RT Countrywide talking about climate crisis and nothing has changed. The farmer rep blames everybody else and offers nothing, and the RT journalist tamely accepts it. RT helps to maintain the status quo as usual. And then Harold Kingston, well-known farmer, says, as a farmer, I am hopping mad hearing John Sweeney on RT Countrywide saying we shouldn't concern ourselves with global emissions as we have to deal with purely Irish legal targets. So thanks for your texts and comments on that. Now, this week, the annual Georgina Campbell Awards were announced, recognising excellence in food and hospitality. One of the winners of a Gong for Person of the Year in the Community Awards category is Claire Nash of Nash 19 Restaurant and Food Shop in Cork, and she's on the line. Congratulations, Claire. Good morning.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
What does this an award like this mean to a business like yours after what you've gone through over the last 18 months?
Oh my God, it just came out of the blue to us, really. We hadn't expected anything. You know, your eyes just on what you're doing at the minute and getting back to some class of normality. The new season rocking on, kids gone back, students back in the city strongly, you know, the new work structure or whatever they're calling it, and the city seems to be getting back to a sense of something changing and something that we all love to do.
Yeah.
And then out of the blue, I get Person of the Year Award, Community Award from Georgina Campbell. We we have worked very hard to just get back, essentially, me and my team. We've been, since lockdown, since the second lockdown, we had a bit of fun, really. We were putting out or getting together a new wine list, going meeting our producers. And, yeah, it was nice to get, you know, it's nice to be recognised. It's nice for the street, for my team, for the city. And just where we trade, we're very lucky, really. And that's, I suppose, why I got it, you know.
Now, from general observation and hearing from others, people seem to be making up for lost time and eating out. What trend are you experiencing? Are you busy?
Oh, very much so. We just had Culture Night last night, which is always a great sense of community and spirit in Cork City, albeit the English Market didn't open. But we have a very nice little gallery at the back of our restaurant, Sternview Gallery. So all the centres of arts were open last night. Lots of people came in, buzzed around, and lots of people booked dinner. The restaurant's very busy in the morning, evening, and right through dinners. Mm. You know, we've expected that it's going to fall off. Maybe Monday, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, we see that. But it's a gorgeous morning this morning. Now, the city has been very busy all week. And, you know, we can just take one week at a time, really, which is what we're doing.
Now, what are you hearing from your colleagues? Is it tough recruiting staff?
Oh, yeah, there's no doubt about it. It's very tough recruiting them. And what I'm finding now is those that have been with me since right through COVID, you know, a couple of them are at breaking point. We're going to close, actually, for a holiday. You'd say, watch, you're closing, you've only reopened. But, you know, we have to mind the teams we have now. We have to be very mindful of what they've gone through. You know, we found it difficult, but right down along the ranks, they've all found it very difficult. We have a lot of people from overseas. Some of them have gone back, which has been highlighted right through the week, and we're waiting for the language students to come back in. The students will get their rosters and schedules now, and they'll settle down to coming back into us, we hope. But our core team, who are hospitality-driven, passionate about what they do, you know, you hang on to them, you really have to with both hands. It's just a different dawning. It's a new way, the art of restaurateurship. Mm. We're worried that that's going to be lost. So those of us that are in it for, the, you know, a long time, I suppose we're trying to draw on any reserve and tools we have now and see where we get with it.
And have costs gone up?
Oh, costs have really gone up, yeah. I mean, you hear all your producers there. Like somebody said earlier on there that, you know, they were not paying enough for food. Like when I watch my growers and what they send in, you know, they're really not charging enough. And I know that a lot of my colleagues will say, what is she talking about? But they're not charging enough for the reverence and the passion and the quality of what they're sending in to us. We're lucky enough to trade near the English Market, but we've so many farmers and growers around us. But the basic cost of food, raw materials, packaging is just gone sky high. It's probably gone 20-30% up. And then obviously wages is another factor that, you know, like it's after increasing by 20-30%, and that's what they're all demanding and that's what they deserve.
Yeah.
So I suppose the next phase now is going to be, you know, price increases. Will the customer tolerate it when all the WSS and everything is pulled back from us? Our working model is going to be very different. But sure, that's the challenge. That's what we keep doing it for, I guess.
Yeah. Well, Claire, congratulations, as I said again. It's a great award. Just one final question briefly. Mm-hmm. Is the COVID pass thing a good thing or a bit of a pain?
It's a good thing because I think that people want to realise that they're going into a safe house.
Yeah.
We have, you know, Eat in the Street, which we're lucky to have. We've a lot of seats outside and they're covered. They're heated. It's working beautifully on Princess Street. But those that want to come indoors, and obviously it's going to start increasing, they want to come in and know that everybody's checked. The COVID pass delays you, but it calms people down as well. You know, it's just another art of trade.
Well, listen, as I said, well done. Congratulations. Thanks very much for joining us, Claire. And the very best of luck in the coming months to you and all the other traders there in Cork. Thanks a million. All right. Bye-bye, Claire. Well, that's all we have time for this week. Sheila O'Callaghan produced. Brian Moss was broadcast coordinator. Mark McGrath on sound. Coming up after the 9 News, playback here on Radio 1. We'll talk to you at the same time next week. Bye-bye and thanks for listening.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal, bringing you expert analysis on what the new CAP deal means for you and your farm payments.